Every year, the El Paso law enforcement agencies send to the DA's office 25,000 cases for prosecution. Okay. The DA's office has 90 budgeted assistant DA positions. Okay. And the number of court systems, we have misdemeanor courts and we have felony courts, district courts. I can tell you it is not possible to prosecute all 25,000 cases. It's just not. And we shouldn't. We have to make priorities about what actually gets presented in court and unfortunately what doesn't. That's the whole point of the DA. That is the single most important aspect of the position is deciding what goes to court and how aggressively it's going to be prosecuted. And are we going to offer alternatives to prosecution?
Hello, and welcome back to the El Paso Beat. I am your host, Richard Henera, and today we have James Montoya, who is running for district attorney. We are covering the district attorney's race. Of course, we're covering all the races as they come up. I think I'm going to actually shift to the sheriff's race next as far as candidates. Of course, actually, I have a couple of other interviews lining up right now that aren't on the election cycle, and so things are going to keep moving. We are going to maintain this very guest-heavy schedule for the meantime. But things are shifting, and it looks like I will be able to start watching the city council meetings at work more flexibly again soon. And if that is indeed the case, then I will feel more inclined to do my city council recap episodes that I used to do in the first iteration of the beat. I kind of miss doing them, and there's a lot going on, that I am aware of, and I would like to take some time to sit and unpack with slash for you guys. So, we'll get there. But for right now, we are focusing on guests. Again, today's is James Montoya. I hope you really enjoy this conversation. I think it's going to be a very good primary election for the DA's race. I think that is necessary so that we put the best candidate forward as the Democrat nominee. And so, I hope you enjoy this conversation, and I will see you on the other side. Well, folks, we are continuing with our conversations with district attorney's candidates because the DA's race is probably, the sheriff's race is pretty packed. I'm not going to lie. That has a very packed race already. But the DA's race is definitely one where everyone is keeping their eyes on, especially the average voter who in the past elections probably wasn't watching the DA's race as closely as they're going to be watching this one because of all the controversy that the office has gone through. So I'm very excited to have our next guest today, and that is James Montoya, who is running for the district attorney's office. And we're going to hear about a little bit about himself and how he got into law and what he looks forward to accomplishing if he gets elected. And so I'd like to welcome Mr. Montoya to the El Paso Beat.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rich. Please, James. That's all right.
All right. If you insist, James. So let's start with your upbringing. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah. So I'm born and raised here in El Paso. Was a product of Socorro ISD schools. Went to Sierra Vista Clark Americas. Graduated from there. And when I graduated from high school, I wanted to get as far away and as fast as possible from El Paso. I think sometimes people feel that way. And
that's a sentiment that's shared.
Yeah. So I was very fortunate. I had gotten into George Washington University. They had a combined 6-year undergrad and law school program. And so I was able to get into that. It was very helpful. It saves a year. So I did undergrad in 3 years and then law school in 3 years. And somewhere in there, I was very fortunate that the summers that I would come back, I was interning at the DA's office when Jaime Esparza was the DA. And that was a very transformative and formative actually time for me, because getting to volunteer there, getting to interact with victims of crime and actually seeing the work of the DA's office really solidified for me that not only did I want to be a lawyer, but I wanted to be a prosecutor specifically. And I didn't want to go be at a law firm, didn't want to go into private practice. This was pretty dead set to what I wanted to do. And over the course of the 6 years that I spent in DC, eventually I knew I wanted to come right back to El Paso. And so I did. I missed the mountains, missed my family, missed the food, missed the culture. You really, in my opinion, you don't really appreciate how special El Paso is until you've traveled, until you've been elsewhere. And leaving certainly gave me a much greater appreciation for my home and for the community that we have here. And so came back. I started at the DA's office immediately. Spent a couple of months prosecuting misdemeanors, low-level family violence, DWIs, things like that. In 2014, I was promoted to our homicide section, our major crime section. And so that handling murders, drunk driving deaths, major, organized crime, violent crime, things like that. And so that's what I ended up handling from 2013 all the way until I left the DA's office, or when I ran for DA last time in 2019, 2020. And so that's what led me to my last campaign. And I really enjoyed my experience. I got to try almost 70 jury trials. Half of them were for murder or capital murder or cases involving someone who had passed away. And so these were very high stress, high stakes trials, but I loved it. It really reinforced why I do this work. And so after I lost the last election, I knew I was not going to work for Ms. Rosales. I knew that right away. During the campaign, it was very clear to me that her and I had some pretty fundamental differences on just how the DA's office should work. And I think we had some pretty fundamental personality differences that would have prevented us from working together in any way whatsoever. But and my decision to not even try to work with her, just say, hey, this is going to be your own thing, was really reinforced when she decided to terminate all of the folks in the DA's office, who had supported me, or I guess she perceived as some sort of loyalist to Jaime Esparza, or I'm not really sure. But she got rid of a lot of folks, and it wasn't just lawyers. It was victim services people. It was receptionists. It was investigators. It was secretaries. It was people who made the day-to-day of the DA's office run and really had literally decades of institutional knowledge. Folks that would have helped her run the office. But for whatever reason, she wanted to go it her own and blaze this fresh path. I think that's really, I'll come back to that, but I really think it was that personnel decision caused a lot of the problems that were later manifested in our criminal justice system. But what I ended up doing was the same week or the same week that the runoff election happened, the United States Supreme Court handed down a transformative case that was involving the state of Oklahoma. Okay. And half of the state of Oklahoma is what used to be called the Indian Territory. Okay? And there's five major tribes there. And the five tribes that are in Oklahoma are actually not from Oklahoma originally. Their homelands are from the Southeast United States, from Florida, from Georgia, the Carolinas, Alabama. For instance, one of them is the Seminole, Florida Seminoles, Florida State Seminoles. The five tribes in Oklahoma were the five that were forcibly deported during the Trail of Tears.
Right.
So Cherokee, Choctaw, Muscogee Creek, Seminole, Chickasaw. So they were deported to Oklahoma during the Trail of Tears, and they were promised that this land here in Oklahoma is going to be yours forever. And of course, it didn't take the United States government very long to renege on that promise. And eventually, it all became the state of Oklahoma. And in 2018, a Native American man, challenged his Oklahoma state conviction that the land that he committed his crime on was still Indian land. And because he was Native American and his crime was committed on a reservation, the state of Oklahoma had no authority over him, and his case needed to be prosecuted in federal court. And that's been the law for a long time. If a crime is committed either by or against a Native American person, and it happens on a reservation, the federal government has jurisdiction, not the state. And what ended up happening was the Supreme Court agreed with this man and said, all of these treaties were never repudiated. They're still in effect. And so all of this land in Oklahoma is still considered native land. And so a lot of state convictions for murder, rape, robbery, all sorts of violent felonies were undone because of this Supreme Court decision. Talking about thousands of cases.
Oh, man.
Big time. It was a huge shift, but it affected nowhere else besides Oklahoma. So,
right. So
it really get a lot of national press, but I can tell you in Oklahoma, this is a huge, huge deal.
Yeah.
What ended up happening were thousands of criminal convictions, state convictions in Oklahoma were undone. And they were having to be prosecuted in federal court by the Justice Department. And so DOJ and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Oklahoma, they wanted violent crime prosecutors in Oklahoma as quickly as possible to start re-prosecuting these old cases and having to start prosecuting new cases. So, you know, for instance, you know, where I was at, I was in a little town called Muskogee, but there was a federal courthouse there because 100 years ago, it was the capital of the Indian Territory. You know, if somebody went and held up a corner store and the clerk was Native American, that was now a federal robbery. And so the Muskogee Police Department would show up, and the first question they ask is, hey, is somebody here Native American? Okay, if it is, this is now a federal case. The FBI needs to get involved. So that's how crazy it was. And so it was a tremendous experience. You know, they were bringing in people from all over the country. Sometimes it kind of felt like college because, you know, people, you know, it was me from El Paso. There was folks from Florida and New York and Arizona and New Jersey. And it was bringing in not just lawyers, prosecutors, but they were having to bring in, you know, federal public defenders and FBI agents and judges from all over, to start addressing this issue. And it was a very rewarding experience. I enjoyed my time out there. I'm not sure that I would ever want to live permanently in Oklahoma. And I really appreciated the time because I knew I was going to eventually get back to El Paso. And I will tell you, I mean, part of the motivation for me leaving was the fact that because Ms. Rosales had let go of so many folks on such short notice that a lot of my dear friends and dear colleagues were left scrambling for work. You know, they were having to, you know, people were applying to the county attorney's office, to the city attorney's office, to all the other, you know, legal positions here in El Paso, people were applying for. And, you know, in some weird way, I felt obliged. Maybe I do need to leave town for a little bit. And so, you know, I accepted this position. When they hired me, they said, we can only guarantee it for 1 year. I said, that's perfect. That's really all I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they at the end of the year, they asked me to stay. I decided not to. Like I said, I knew eventually I was going to come back home and missed all of the reasons that I had when I left for college. And so I got back, and I was very fortunate that about the time I was looking to come home, there was an opening at the public defender's office. And so at El Paso County, And a few of my coworkers from the DA's office who were terminated by Ms. Rosales, they had gone and become defense lawyers and had become public defenders. And they had really enjoyed their experience. They had all said to me, how eye-opening it was to see things from the other side, how much it meant to them, really to see how much work goes into being a defense lawyer. And they expressed to me how important it was that they thought I should do it. And I trusted them, and I applied, and I was very fortunate that the public defender, Kelly Childress, she gave me an opportunity. I know there was a few people in the public defender's office that were a bit skeptical about hiring me, because I had been up until that point a career prosecutor. But my attitude was, look, you want me to broaden my world experience, see what it is that you all do? Here I am. I'm ready to do that. And so very fortunate she gave me that opportunity. I've now been a public defender since last October, so coming up on a year now. And it has been an eye-opening experience. It's been I certainly always had a great deal of respect for the work that defense lawyers and especially public defenders do, but it's given me a greater appreciation of all the things I never really thought about.
Is there something in particular?
I mean, I'll tell you actually that the one thing I never really thought about was dealing with clients' family members. Okay. Dealing, if I have a client accused right now, I've been assigned to major crimes. So I am now defending people accused of very serious felony offenses, kind of the same people that I was prosecuting before. Now I'm defending. But I will tell you the part that has been most fascinating is interacting with clients' family members, explaining, talking to their mothers or their wives or whoever else they might have in their family that they want you to talk to, because, well, they're not really the client. Right, you're not a, legally required to speak to them.
Right.
Certainly, if you want to maintain a positive
Some
relationship with
rapport.
a client, yeah, then you certainly need to engage with their family members if that's what they would like. But also you get to the point where you have to tell them, hey, I do not have a privileged relationship with you. There's no confidentiality between you and I, and I'm not going to repeat everything that I told to, your son or your brother to you. So, that was certainly something I never really gave a lot of thought to, as a prosecutor, the work that goes on behind. But it's been, having to go to the jail or having to go to the jail annex on the Far East Side and meet with clients and explain to them, hey, these are the charges against you. This is the evidence that's against you. Here are your options. We can fight this all the way, go to trial. I love trial. If you want a trial, we'll give you a trial. But sometimes a trial's not the best idea. And so, I've been very fortunate thus far as a defense lawyer. I've in the year that I've been a defense lawyer, I've had two jury trials. One, I got an acquittal, full acquittal for a client. That was a very rewarding experience. It was a position that I never thought I'd find myself in, asking a jury to find somebody not guilty. And when they did come back not guilty, it was the appropriate verdict. It was the correct verdict. And I know my client was very grateful. And so was his family, and it was certainly a positive feeling. My other client wasn't so lucky, but that's the way the system is. I've been doing this long enough. I've had enough jury trials to know that, to me, justice is whatever the jury says it is. If the process is fair, if everybody did their job, if the prosecutor did their job, if the defense lawyer did their job, if the judge did their job. If everybody did their job right, the outcome, whatever the outcome is, whatever the 12 members of the jury, what the community says is the appropriate verdict, that's what justice is. So But it's been, like I said, certainly never a position I ever thought I'd find myself in, but very grateful. I feel confident saying that I certainly feel like a stronger, more well-rounded candidate now that I've done federal work, now that I've done criminal defense work. I'm the only candidate running for DA that's done federal work or been a criminal defense lawyer who can actually say, I've seen both sides. And, it informed me to the extent that, the DA's office, they work closely with law enforcement. They work with law enforcement to bring these cases to court to be prosecuted. And every year, the El Paso law enforcement agencies send to the DA's office 25,000 cases for prosecution. Okay. And that's from the El Paso Police Department, Sheriff's Office, the school district police departments, Horizon, Socorro Police Department, all of the El Paso County DPS, 25,000 cases. Okay. The DA's office has 90 budgeted assistant DA positions. Okay. And the number of court systems, we have misdemeanor courts and we have felony courts, district courts. I can tell you it is not possible to prosecute all 25,000 cases. It's just not. And we shouldn't. We have to make priorities about what actually gets presented in court and unfortunately what doesn't. Sometimes it ends with the investigation and it does not go into court. And that's the whole point of the DA. That is the single most important aspect of the position is deciding what goes to court and how aggressively it's going to be prosecuted. And are we going to offer alternatives to prosecution, or are we going to offer alternatives to jury trials? And I've always thought, I was very fortunate that when I was handling homicides, serious cases, those were always worthy prosecutions. There was never any question, oh, are we going to prosecute this person for murder? Well, yes, of course. Most of the time, it was a question of what is the appropriate punishment? What is the appropriate sentence? But I will tell you, of the 25,000 cases, there's less than 50 of them on any given year are homicides. The vast majority are smaller kinds of crimes. DWIs, El Paso, last time I checked, we have approximately 3,000 DWI arrests a year, approximately 3,000 family violence arrests every year. Shoplifting, vehicle burglaries, things like that, where we have to prioritize, hey, which ones are we going to pursue and which ones we're not? Small amounts of marijuana, small amounts of controlled substances, those are all in that mix. And it's up to the DA to decide, hey, how are we going to prioritize which cases we pursue? And being a defense lawyer, I think has informed me about, which are the hills to die on?
Worth
Where
dying on, yeah.
really, yeah, right. Where is it? We have limited resources. It is impossible to prosecute every case. We got to make choices. And at the end of the day, the community has to, if you were a juror and you came into jury duty and they end up telling you're here for a case involving possession of cocaine, less than 1 gram, less than a paper clip. I don't think you'd be very happy being called in for jury duty,
No,
missing a day of
missing
work.
work,
Right.
will bark downtown, all that
Right.
trouble. Yeah.
Exactly. And so, we have to be mindful of what we're asking jurors to decide. If there's a way to resolve a case without going to trial, we should. Is there, so much of being a prosecutor is using your discretion. There are dangerous people in our community that who want to hurt and will hurt other people because they are dangerous. And those people need to be literally separated from society by going off to the penitentiary. But I will tell you that it's not that many people. There is a number of people that do that. The vast majority of the people that find themselves in the criminal justice system, sometimes they're mistakes, sometimes they're folks that made bad choices in the moment, bad timing, bad, their life has led them to this particular point, and they made a bad choice. A lot of them have mental health issues. A lot of them have substance abuse issues. And so we have to ask ourselves, are these people that we want to incarcerate? Or are these people we want to supervise, on probation? Because, or are these people that, we can formulate some kind of sentence, where they are held accountable, but we don't spend these resources either incarcerating them or supervising them. There's different, gradations of offense. It costs us $100 a day to lock somebody up in the El Paso County Jail. $100 a day per inmate. We have to ask ourselves, is it worth it? Is it worth paying $100 to lock this particular person up for one day? Sometimes the answer is very easy, yes, right? And other times not so much. And we have to be mindful that when we do incarcerate somebody, there are, collateral consequences to that. Someone's in jail, on a burglary of a vehicle, and they're in jail for, 3 or 4 days. What if they lose their job? Okay. They lose their job. They were the family provider. What happens now? Are we really making our community safer by putting this person in jail for a couple of days, making them lose their job, and now when they get out, they have to find some new source of income, right? To me, my goal as the DA will always be what makes our community safer. Sometimes prosecuting people to the fullest extent of the law, that's what's necessary. But other times, and I would say most of the time, prosecuting somebody to the max is not necessarily the wisest use of resources, of our limited resources. And so that's, as a DA, that you got to set these policies for the assistant DAs. Like I said, we're budgeted for 90 lawyers.
Right.
I can tell you right now, the DA's office is not at 90 lawyers. Okay. The number kind of fluctuates. I think right now there's maybe around 70. It's more than under Ms. Rosales. And to me, that is the number one issue facing the DA's office right now,
Okay.
is their continued understaffing.
Okay.
Simply do not have enough lawyers that are well trained to handle the number of cases that they have. Okay? And it goes back to Ms. Rosales when she let go of all these folks. I don't know if she thought people were gonna start applying for her afterwards or what happened, but she let go of these people without replacements lined up. And ever since then, they've never been able to get out of that hole. And so, when you hear these stories in El Paso Inc. or El Paso Matters or the El Paso Times about people who were sitting in jail for more than 3 months without a charge being filed against them, it's because they didn't have enough people. When people have been out on bond, on a PR bond for up to 2 years, and they still haven't had their charges filed against them, it's because the DA's office didn't have enough qualified people. And I will tell you, things are a little bit better now. Some folks have gone back to the DA's office, but we're still seeing a lot of the same issues. There are still hundreds, if not thousands, of cases where more than 6 months have gone by between when the person was arrested and they still haven't actually had a charge filed in court. More than 6 months. And I'm telling you, I don't know the exact number. It's several hundred, possibly even more than 1,000.
Eesh.
Okay. And I know Mr. Hicks is trying to do his job or trying to do as best as can, but I think there's still a lot of uncertainty, stability in the DA's office. People are paranoid about getting fired the next day, how they used to. But my sense, being in the courthouse at the public defender's office, dealing with the DA's office, is that office morale is still not great. There's still I still think there's a pretty significant lack of training. Where honestly, sometimes I see cases that they're dismissing, and I'm asking myself, why are you dismissing? This is a case that probably should go to trial. And then some of the cases that are going to trial, I'm asking myself, is this the most, is this the best use of your time and resources? And frankly, it's because I just don't know what kind of guidance they're getting from the top about how they should be allocating their time and their attention. Because even with the busiest judges, the judges that want to go to trial, that are willing to go to trial, even in a good year, okay, you have to exclude Christmas, Christmas, New Year's, that time period,
Holidays and such.
have jury duty then. Best case scenario, each individual judge, maybe, again, best case scenario, 40 jury trials a year, maybe, right? Back when I was in the DA's office, my personal goal was one jury trial a month, 12 jury trials a year. And I would get pretty close to that, between 10 and 12 every year. And so we have to choose, like I said,
Choose your battles.
going back to the same, thing. You got to choose your battles, pick the hills to die on. What matters? What are we going to get invested in? And I feel like I've been rambling a lot. You haven't asked me a
That's what
question.
podcasts are. That's that's what pod is. And you know what? You have and just to comfort you just for a sec, you have touched on things that I would have asked you, and you've kind of touched on them. And so, like, don't worry, you're answering
Good. I
questions
feel
as you
like
go.
I'm flowing pretty
You
good,
are. You are. You're doing a
and
good job.
hoping
Don't
it
stress.
all comes
Don't
together.
stress.
Because I guess one of the questions I get a lot, or that I got last time, and I've heard from a few folks this time, is, why does the DA need to be a trial lawyer? Isn't it an administrative position? Isn't it a managerial position? And I get where that question is coming from, but I think it's fundamentally flawed, because at the end of the day, the DA, what the DA is and what they need now especially, is a leader. Okay. Somebody who can lead from the front, who can say, this is my vision of what our criminal justice system should look like here in El Paso. This is what I want you prioritizing. Now you know how I want you to handle these cases and how I want you spending your time. Go forth, right? Use your discretion, in my name, as the elected official. You are exercising your power on my behalf, and I'm exercising power on behalf of the electorate, on behalf of the community. And so, when I say, James Montoya for the state of Texas, I am the community's representative in the courtroom, in our criminal justice system. Use your discretion wisely. And I really don't think you can do that unless you're a trial lawyer. And I will tell you, Jaime Esparza, he was a great trial lawyer. And if people had questions about a case, or how they wanted to resolve something, or they needed advice, people felt comfortable going to him. Okay. People respected him. I'm not sure that the office ever felt that way about Ms. Rosales. She was not somebody that, I don't think, my sense, I wasn't there. But my sense is that if you had a question about a case, or you had a tough evidentiary issue, she was not somebody that people felt comfortable going to. And frankly, I'm not sure that she was someone that people respected. And I think that's really important. And if your assistant prosecutors don't feel comfortable coming to you and asking for your advice, well, then how can you expect them to fulfill your policies or expect them to fulfill your vision of what you think, our criminal justice system should be, what the priority should be? And I think you only get that respect and that understanding if you've been in trial, if you've tried cases, if you've tried serious cases, and people will tell you, when you talk to lawyers in the community, they will tell you, who is not afraid of trial, who know, who will have their back, who is ready to go into the courtroom, and those are the people that command respect. And I think that's something that I would bring to the position. And there are people who are willing to go back to the DA's office, with me. And I think that's really important because, again, being the DA, one person cannot solve this thing. One person, the DA's office is does not, rise or fall on the back of one person. It, like I said, it's just too much. 25,000 cases a year. And so unless you have a team, unless you have people willing to go in there and help you, it's not going to work. It's just not going to happen. And so, I am confident telling you, I have folks who want to work for me, who are willing to go back, who are willing to put in the time, and stabilize this thing. And if there, like I said, if there's any silver lining in what happened, during Ms. Rosales's term, the things that she dismantled, is that there is now an opportunity to, build something new, start afresh. I tell folks there's no way we can go back. There's no way we can go back to the way things were. And I'm not sure I want to. We have to find a new way forward. It is going to take us literally years to rebuild what Ms. Rosales dismantled, to rebuild that institutional knowledge, that level of lawyers that are there from 5 to 10 years who can mentor younger lawyers, create a new training regime. This is a long-term project. It's something that I want to get into. This is, in my opinion, this is not something that's going to be able to be fixed in one term or even 2 terms. Under Jaime Esparza, he was the DA for 28 years, and there were some prosecutors there who spent their entire careers, 20 years, 25 years at the county, working just for him. And I think there's pros and cons to that kind of longevity in office, but I think right now what the DA's office needs most crucially is long-term stability and continuity. If we're ever hoping to stabilize and go on. 'Cause right now, I will tell you right now, the ship is not sinking. It's not actively sinking, but it's floundering.
Take on some water. It has some water in
Yeah,
it. Let's take on
definitely.
some water.
Definitely.
I kind of have a question, and this might
Yeah.
be the question that we leave on this, depending on how much you ramble on here. No, I'm
Yeah.
just kidding.
Yeah, no.
So you on the sense of like we need to rebuild the stability. That's what people are looking for. I don't disagree. I have mentioned this in the past that this, unlike other DA's races that I haven't like been vested in, but I have like some been somewhat aware of in other places of the country. I've noticed that those DA's races are very kind of culture war focused. There's a lot of it becomes very partisan, and the lines of like how you feel about criminal justice reform and different things like and how those opinions fall on the partisan spectrum, those really started to come out in the DA's races. This race, I feel, and you've said over the course of the conversation that it's all about stability. People want to see this office get back to just running as it should be and just and going. You have the perspective of having been in there before when it was running functionally as an intern and coming up in the office. And like you said, you have the opportunity to build something new. So where do you see the line in your vision between the old stable and maybe something new, something where that where the Reformation does come in.
Yeah.
What is something that you would like to introduce or make progress on?
Yeah, so great question. And I think you hit it exactly on nail on the head. I when I tell you that, I think there needs to be explicit written prior, policies on what cases need to be prioritized. I think assistant prosecutors need to be given greater guidance about how they should be resolving cases. As crazy as this sounds, Richard, right now there's no policy that says you should prioritize crimes of violence over property crimes or drug crimes. That's not written down. I don't know if that's a directive that's given orally. To me, it's not very clear. Like I said, what I have seen so far as a public defender is there does not seem to be any particular rhyme or reason on how cases are resolved or what is prioritized. And I think that does a disservice to really everyone in the criminal justice system. It does a disservice to the young prosecutors that are having to figure out how to use their discretion. It does a disservice to defense lawyers because we feel very frustrated. Don't you all have other cases you need to be focusing on instead of my client that's charged with, some low-level misdemeanor or low-level felony? Does a disservice to the community because again, I think if the community found out what kinds of cases weren't being prioritized,
Chasing after,
yeah,
yeah.
right. And so to me, I want to make a very clear, I don't want to say requirements because every case is different. There isn't a one size fits all approach to criminal justice, certainly not to individual cases, but we do want similarly situated defendants who are charged with similar crimes dealt with similarly. I mean, just because your case ends up with one judge, you get charged with DWI and you end up with one judge, and somebody else charged with the same DWI or similar DWI ends up with a different judge, you should get similar outcomes. It should not depend on your judge. It should not depend necessarily on your defense lawyer. It shouldn't depend on the prosecutor that you get. We want, there is something to be said about consistency and uniformity in outcomes.
Absolutely.
But on the other hand, we also, we need to balance it where individual circumstances in each case are taken into account, and the individual characteristics of the offender, of the circumstances of the crime, any mitigating circumstances, those are taken into account also. And so it's when I say that I'm going to develop these prosecution policies, I think policies is too strong. I really prefer guidelines to kind of shape the discretion. Because like I said, at least what I've seen too much of is a disparity of outcomes. And to me that doesn't sit well with me.
No, for
But
sure. And people the people realize that too, because like if people have experienced two of the same minor misdemeanor, and they say, well, I went to the court and like this is all that happened, and then the other guy says, well, I went to the court and I got a way more severe sentence, and it's like, and if they can't figure out between the two of them what the difference was, then like it creates nothing but distrust in the system. And so no, I agree with that. That makes a lot of sense. We got a
And it,
little bit of, oh, go ahead.
yeah. And I think if there's more consistency, it builds more trust in the system. And then defense lawyers can confidently tell their clients, hey, based on my experience, I think this is what's going to happen in your case. And it builds trust between them. And I will tell you the other big thing that I want to get into is more data-driven decision making.
I like
I've been
that.
working with this before, but this morning I was at the Borderland Rainbow Center and I was having a conversation with their director, Amber Bettis, and we were talking about family violence, and that was a big thing. And it was a kind of an issue for some folks in the last election because we had very aggressive prosecution policies under Jaime Esparza. that I know rubbed a lot of folks the wrong way. Ms. Rosales, when she took office, she dismantled the family violence unit in the DA's office. That was no longer, there was no central clearinghouse for those kinds of cases. And seen some pretty disturbing things in family violence cases here, where, you know, sometimes the victims will say, "I don't want to prosecute." And for a while under Ms. Rosales, if the victim said they didn't want to prosecute, that was it, dismissed. Well, okay, things are a little bit more complicated than that. Sometimes it's a genuine, I don't want to prosecute, but the science shows that sometimes, you know, there is a cycle of violence. There are women that feel coerced or pressured to not prosecute. And it's up to the DA, to the assistant DAs to discern, hey, is this a genuine wish or not? But you know, when I was talking with Ms. Bettis, you know, she asked, you know, is there some way to know, you know, what percentage of family violence cases involve the LGBTQ community? I don't know. I don't, I'm not sure if that's tracked, you know, and I think that is something that should be tracked, you
Sure,
know,
yeah.
it should be, you know, how much of it is domestic partners or, intimate relationship partners versus, you know, family members, because sometimes even brothers or dads and sons or you know, brother sisters, that's categorized as family violence. Of course, because, I mean, they are family members. I think how you handle intimate partner violence versus, you know, sibling,
Siblings, right.
yeah, or parental, you know, child violence, I think those are two separate paths.
Fair, that's fair.
And so, you know, I'm a big believer in data. I like it. I want decisions to be driven by that. I will tell you, I recently saw an open records request that gun violence has skyrocketed.
I bet. I believe it.
And you know, I certainly felt that way when you see the news. You know,
Yeah.
it feels like there's more gun violence, but then
Right.
you
Yeah.
is this just reporting? Is it anecdotal? But you know, I finally saw a PIA request that shows that since January of 21, since Ms. Rosales started her term, there was a steady and demonstrable increase in gun violence. Now, I'm sure there's a combination of a number of factors.
Right, I won't let you
Yeah.
just say that's all
Yeah. Yeah.
on Rosales. There's a whole
Oh,
bunch of factors
no.
there,
And
but
plenty. But I can tell you, let you know, when people are out on bond for years and nothing is happening with their cases,
right,
I,
that certainly doesn't help.
right, that is a factor,
Yeah.
and you know, I that's important to me. I want to be making, you know, if we're seeing an uptick in gun violence, I think the prosecution guidelines, the priorities, that's where they need to follow, you
Okay.
know. So I'm someone that's committed to that.
Makes
So.
sense. I appreciate that. And I too am I'm kind of a it's weird. I hate numbers, but I love data. It's I don't know. It's weird. We have a little bit of time. Let's squeeze this one in because I would like you to weigh in on this. Obviously, the city council is not going to listen to this and at the edge of their seat waiting for your opinion on it, but I would like to know as a potential DA, and you'd be working with our new potential police chief later this week, and unfortunately people aren't going to hear this before this happens, but this coming Wednesday the city council are kind of taking the last four police chief candidates on tour in a sense so that the community can get to know them, asking questions, yada yada yada. What I would like to know is what you as a DA would like to see from a new police chief as a for synergy purposes.
Yeah, so I think the number one quality I would want to see in chief is someone who's open-minded and collaborative. I think you know, if we want to, there was a breakdown in the law enforcement relationship between the DA's office and various agencies, including EPPD, during Ms. Rosales, and I think that did have an effect on cases and on public safety. Generally, here in El Paso, I think it's critical to have a working relationship with the police chief, with the police department as a whole. You know, we work, the DA obviously works closely with law enforcement, but we're also an important check and balance on those agencies. I mean, respectfully, I think the DA's office is really in the best position to provide oversight and accountability to these agencies because we're working with them so frequently. You know, I think we're in the best position to say, hey, you know, we got to be doing better on this. You ought not to be doing that. You know, what is the best practice for this particular problem?
Situations, right?
Yeah, right. For all sorts of things, right? So that's really what I would be looking for in a chief, somebody who's open to collaborating, someone who's open to thinking outside the box. I think it's important that they pick somebody who is respected by the rank and file officers. I think that's what makes, you know, a chief effective. You know, if you're not respected by the folks out there in the field, well, you know,
You're
how
gonna have
effective
issues.
are you really going to be? Yeah, right. And so
It'd be
I,
like a
it's
DA not
not
having
my
respect from
right,
their assistant
right,
DAs.
exactly. And so you know, I saw the background of all the officers. I haven't worked with all the nominees. You know, all of them seem very well qualified. They all seem to have, you know, extensive law enforcement experience. And so I think the city's done a good job of
Narrowing it
selecting
down to
the
this.
candidate.
That's perfect.
And you know, I look forward, you know, if I'm fortunate enough to be the DA, I look forward to working with you know, I would have liked to have seen a female candidate, and
I saw that and thought that too,
you
because there was
yeah.
also a lot of coverage about, you know, recently the in El Paso Police Department, how there is issues with how women are being treated, female officers are being treated in the force. And so I did mentally note that there weren't any women in the finalists, but you know, I don't know the whole story either. I mean, I don't know. So but yeah, you know, maybe the next chief. Where can people find out more about you, more about your campaign, if they want to get involved or reach out to you?
Yeah, so I have a lot of information on my Facebook page. It's just James Montoya for District Attorney, website jamesmontoya.com. I will also encourage people, give me a call. I'm happy to talk to if you got concerns, come right to me. My cell phone 915-603-7973. That's my personal cell. You can also email me Montoya4DA@gmail.com. You know, I'm happy to speak directly to folks. I think that's really important. It's my favorite part of running for office,
That's fun.
yeah, is the direct engagement. So if anybody has any questions, don't hesitate to reach out.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for taking this time on your Sunday afternoon. I really do appreciate it. And I hope the listeners really enjoyed it. And I wish you the best of luck out there on your campaign.
Thanks. Appreciate it, Richard. Thanks for the invite.
Once again, I'd like to thank James Montoya for joining us here on the El Paso Beat. If you'd like to check out more about him or his campaign, I'm going to have all of his information listed in the description for the episode, so you can go ahead and do that. Be sure to check him out on his social medias and such. If you haven't listened to the other conversation that we have for the DA's race, that is with Miss Nancy Casas. That happened last week. You can check out that episode as well. Right now, these episodes are only available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. However, very, very soon, again, impending the ever looming soon, I will be on all the other podcasting platforms again. I will, I promise. I have actually been asked about it. I do know that that was actually more of where my numbers came from when I was on the other podcast. You know, though, I will just throw this out there now that you know, since I've been back into circulation now and I've been making clips again, I am starting to pull in people thanks to the social media stuff, you know, that Meta is now using the TikTok style algorithm for putting reels in front of people randomly, especially if they're in your friends list or followers list. I am starting to get more people, more traction off of the social media clips. So I appreciate it when you like and share those clips. Also, when you like and subscribe to the social media pages, you can find me at the El Paso Beat on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. You know how to reach me. You can message me on those. You can also email me at theelpasobeat@gmail.com. Let me know who you want to hear from. Let me know what you are thinking. Let me know what you want me to ask them. And I did not get around to talking about this recall election, the one that for Cassandra Hernandez. I will say very quickly that I think it is an irresponsible use of money at this point. I just don't. And then there is something that I have to fact check, but it is slightly possible that like she might not even be legally be able to be ousted within the last year of her term. I have to look into that. And now I am also hearing rumors about who is indeed going to be running in this race. It is getting interesting, but we will have to cover that another time because this episode is already kind of running a little bit long, and I don't want to keep you guys here for that long. So we will pick this up again next time. This podcast is produced by Richard Henneta, features music by Enrique Ponce, and we'll see you on the next episode.